everybody. What's going on? Welcome back. Today we sat down with David Kennedy. David was originally supposed to be on the first Chuck Powell episode with us, but had to cancel because he was under the weather the day we recorded. So we finally got him back on, and the dude did not disappoint. He is so much fun to talk to. He's got a lot of stories, a lot of experience. He caught his first Michigan Bobcat this year, so we talked a little about that. We just had an awesome time. So here we go, episode 22 with our friend David Kennedy.
Let's talk about it.
Snowflake, you think, okay.
Well, only because we use it in a way that makes... Let's get into it. Welcome to another startling episode of Rax, Fur, and Feathers.
That beautiful voice you just heard is Adam Peterson.
Hello,
as
hello.
Always. Sitting to his left is David Kennedy, our guest today.
Hi.
And then we got Ray Cole, as always, with his own microphone again. You're on a roll, man.
How goes it?
You guys will have to give him a minute. He's in the smoking section, so.
All right. So, first on our list that we were just talking about.
We have to address.
And apparently we disagree.
I don't disagree that I don't find it an offensive term.
We should tell everybody what we're talking about.
Yes.
So, what happened was, about a week ago? I posted the episode with Mike Bussing, who is the executive producer for NBI Studios, as you guys all know.
Right.
I posted it on the Truth and Justice fan page. Now, you guys listening to this know that we drop a lot of F-bombs. This show isn't for the weak-hearted. So in the post, all I said was, if you're a snowflake, this podcast probably isn't for you, but if you guys want to hear some good old boys drink and talk hunting and fishing with
right.
your favorite executive producer, give it a click, give it a listen. That's all I said, and it took about 15 minutes for that to get taken down because I used the term snowflake and pissed everybody off.
And it's funny, the way it works out is you usually tend to find out who is a snowflake when you use that word because they're the ones that give you the most crap for using it, right? So they kind of make the argument for you that it's not a bad thing that you're using the word, but, you know, there's no reason to apologize for it. You didn't mean any derogatory, you didn't mean any harm by it. You were just using the term as a term. It'd be like me calling somebody jumpy or just any other adjective you could use to describe somebody.
There's so many things you can't use now.
Right.
I don't think you can use shooting fish out of a barrel because that's it's not fair for the fish.
Poor fish are trapped in a barrel.
Yeah.
Peter will have a fucking heart attack.
So that's the one thing that our show has been lucky enough to stay away from for the most part so far has been all the political correct nonsense that if you guys don't like what we're saying, you just have to deal with it, I guess, because we talk the way that we get along. We get along the way that we talk, and there's no harm meant by it. We're not singling out anybody in a derogatory way. We're not trying to make enemies, but we're certainly not trying to offend anybody in the process of being who we are and doing what we do. So,
well said, brother.
Thank you.
Way to smooth that over
That's
for us.
That's what I'm here for.
So, to all you snowflakes out there... We're sorry.
You guys might want to hang out. It's going to get hot.
Dude, we've been getting a shit ton of downloads from the San Jose area.
Really?
Yeah. Showing some love, dude. And now that we're on all these other directories, so just want to give a shout out to them because that's kind of odd. I wouldn't see San Jose, which is the LA area, right?
It's down in the Southwest. They got a lot of turkeys down there, I think, don't they? Turkeys and maybe even some bobcats.
Shit, dude.
So,
you'll find out if there's a bunch of snowflakes down there
That's
too
right,
right now.
Well, hopefully if they're downloading the show, they're not too upset with us yet. I mean, isn't all publicity good publicity? Isn't that the way it goes?
Yeah, I guess. And, you know, the way I look at a lot, it's really cool when I look at all the different places that have been downloading our show. You
mm-hmm.
know, we get a map
right.
every week that shows us what cities are downloading what countries. We get a handful from across the pond. You know, we got a couple over in Ireland, the UK, Australia actually just jumped on board.
Crikey,
mate. So, I mean, all that's cool. It's just, I don't know why I'm a geek. I think it's interesting to look at, you know, who's listening to us. I just thought it was really odd that San Jose was where it's at. But there's probably a lot of don't-knows in that area. So.
Right, and on that point, if there's anybody in the San Jose listening area and you guys want to shoot us a message on Facebook or let us know what we could do to better the podcast for you or address an issue that you might have in your particular area, we'd love to hear from you guys. You know, if you guys are picking us up and listening to us, let us know what we can do to make it better. Let us know if we're doing something wrong or if we're doing something right. You know, give us some feedback.
hopefully we're encouraging them to get on an airplane or get in their truck and drive over to Michigan and do some hunting.
Absolutely. It's a big jump from San Jose, but we're here. It's a nice place this time of year. There's no snowflakes right now.
Which is odd for December. Right. Almost all the way through it and haven't had any yet.
Dude, I was working in a t-shirt today outside.
That's crazy.
We had a little snow in November, about, what, 8 inches or so, but
yeah,
that was it.
But that scares me, though, because that usually means January and February are going to be awful. Shit.
Yeah.
That's usually how that ends up.
Well, they're threatening a little bit for, what, Friday night, but actually, not really a lot. Man.
I heard the phrase polar vortex being tossed around, and that,
That brings back memories, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah.
For those of you who don't know, what was it, 3 or 4, 5, it was longer than that, like 5, 6 years ago, when that polar vortex
settled over us.
Yeah.
We were dealing with like negative 55 degrees Fahrenheit, you know.
Not quite that cold, but it was fucking cold.
Well, yeah, like negative 35, yeah, negative 40. Cold. People were advised not to go outside. All the snow turned to ice. All the ice stuck on the roads. It was awful.
Ice fishing was hot, though.
Yeah, it was. That was the only good thing you could do if you could manage to get out and not die on the way to the shanties. That's the kind of temperature, like, as soon as you breathe out, the moisture in your breath condenses and it just drops straight to the ground like ice cubes.
Right. So for those of you that have been out ice fishing now, somewhere, I'm sure there's ice in the northern states.
Yeah.
Not here, but...
We damn sure don't have it, but...
But make sure you post the pictures on our group page. Get on there. Let's see what you're doing. You guys search us on Facebook, I should clarify this real quick. I've been meaning to do it for a couple episodes now, and I keep forgetting. There is our official page that you guys should like, and then there is a profile page that I technically handed over to you, Mr. Mustachio.
And I've done nothing with it.
I tried to get him on Facebook. I tried to get him on Facebook. But so if you find a Rax Fur and Feather profile page, we don't really do anything with it. We should just discontinue that damn thing.
Someday we will.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it'll pick up and we'll get to use it. I don't know.
Right. Yep.
The door is open. You guys want to walk through it? It's up to you.
Next on the list. We need to congratulate
Mr. Kevin Swanson, a friend of ours that we met this summer up in Marquette. He was the, correct me if I'm wrong, the head of the large mammal or large carnivore specialist for the DNR for the state.
Predator.
Right. And so basically he was the one that dealt with the wolves, the mountain lions, what couple, you know, here and there.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Yeah, some bears. So he took a new job. And to step away from the DNR, you got to have something pretty good going on. Or I'm sure he wouldn't have done it if it wasn't to better himself. So we want to congratulate him on the move. Apologize to the DNR for the giant hole that he left when he left.
If you guys want to hear from him, it's episodes 15 and 16, I think.
I believe so. Yeah, right around in there.
Yeah. Cool dude. Real cool dude. So congratulations, Kevin. We'll be sure to hit him up and see what the hell he's doing. Maybe
we'll just get
another interview with him. We should update the listeners on the doe skull situation, that spike doe that I shot the other day. The unicorn. I finally got around to I skinned out the face, you know. I didn't do the whole urim out shit with the boiling and getting the brains out and the eyeballs. Kind of ran out of ambition after a while because it was...
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but what's weird, normally when you skin a skull for a Euro mount, you get up to the antlers, there's that real nice base, and you just, you know, you pry away from underneath it, you know, it's pretty cut and dry. We're not going to lie. It's right there. This was fucking crazy, because she had no base, and I was having trouble figuring out where the hide ended and where the velvet began.
That's nuts. Yeah, you said there was no pedicle on that. There's no...
No, it's just nothing. It's coming right up from the skull. And then she had another little bump on the other side.
Huh.
Crazy. But, what I ended up doing, I went up about half an inch, 3/4 of an inch, to where I decided it's not fur anymore. and it's velvet. And I just kind of gave it a fade. You know what I mean? Tried to blend it in. I don't know if that velvet's going to stay on there.
Hope so.
Yeah, me too.
If not, take a bunch of pictures of it and tell everybody what it used to look like.
So if anybody's got any advice, I could use it.
On how to preserve it, right?
Yeah.
Is it soft still?
No, it's hard underneath. But like I noticed when I was doing the fade, you know, when I was cutting into it, there's it's not like hard bone right underneath. I mean, there's still like some tissue, you know what I mean?
Some velvet material, sort of.
I can't even, like, almost like a skin. There's like the velvet and then a skin, and then there's the bone underneath. But mm-hmm. I mean, it's nobody can see my fingers right now.
Well, it's a very small amount.
Right.
The point.
But it's, so. I mean, you would think that tissue would rot, right? Or that skin.
Yeah, I mean, if it's left on there long enough, it will dry up or rot off.
So I don't know. Help me out, listeners.
Yeah.
And your coffee seasoning was amazing, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. Update, those of you who may not have listened to the last episode, I made a seasoning combination with some coffee and some garlic powder and some onion powder to try and just let Bert know, mostly, that it's possible to cook with coffee. And he tried it, and it turned out well, so.
Really good. I was really surprised.
Did it taste like coffee to you? Did it?
Nah, no. It was different.
Yeah.
But it was good. Really good.
That's the best way I can describe it, is it smells like coffee when you put it on, but it almost takes like a roast flavor, sort of. Like, it gives it sort of a depth that is hard to replicate.
You ever use that for like a dry rub on like a...
Oh, yeah. It works well for dry rubs. It's really good as a conventional seasoning, but if you want to like use it as a marinade for a dry rub, it is just aces. I mean, it does really well for that. So
if you haven't already, you want to remind them what you already put in there?
Can I say the name of the coffee? Or
Jehovah?
Javalia. Folgers will work. Maxwell House, whatever you got. Just standard coffee. Decaf, regular, doesn't matter.
Not instant, just a regular
brew type. I've never used the instant coffee. That is so strong, I'd be scared to use it. But yeah, just the regular coffee grounds, right out of the bag or right out of the box, barrel, however you get it. And I just mix that with some more savory seasonings like garlic powder, onion powder, a little bit of salt, not much. You don't really want to overdo it with that. You can always add more of that stuff later, but just for the seasoning, coffee is good. It's like cinnamon. If you back it up with the right seasonings behind it, you'll get a really good product out of it at the end. You know, you could just put straight coffee on it, and I don't know what I don't guess it would taste great. But if you put things behind it that kind of help bring out the certain notes of the coffee, you know, the savory elements of it really shine. They really come through, and it makes for a delicious bite.
Fantastic job, man, because that was awesome.
I wouldn't know, because you brought two bags. Bert took two bags and gave my bag to his dad. So.
Oh, I gave some to Mike. He was here.
I got him a bag. I split the bag that I brought home. And I was supposed to bring him the other half, Sunday?
Yep.
Watching football?
Yep.
I was supposed to bring it over to cook some Venn steaks, and he said, make sure you grab my seasoning. And I grabbed Lowry's, because 2 or 3 weeks before that, he brought Lowry's over and left it. So, like, I got your seasoning.
Right.
Like, I said Jehovah seasoning.
Now we're going to get shit for that. You guys realize?
No. We should have used that on those ribs that TJ tried cooking, though, apparently. Did you ever get a chance to try them?
I didn't.
Yeah, we're not even going to touch that. All right, so how'd your deer season go,
David? Mr. Kennedy?
I thought we were going to skip that part, too.
Oh, boy.
That good, huh?
That well.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. I hunted 4 whole times archery, and got some hair up my butt about trapping, and ended up hunting once during gun season. No, I hunted opening morning of gun season, and then one evening sometime after that, and that's been it. So,
and sticking with the trapping, huh?
Yeah, which probably wasn't a great idea because it doesn't fill the freezer very well.
Right. Oh, yeah. I need that red meat stacked up, man.
Yeah. I normally have 2 big ones or 3, you know, that I can go through just myself in a year. So it's going to be a little bit skinny of a year for deer meat for me.
That elk you had in your profile picture, though, on Facebook, where'd you shoot that thing at, man? That was a nice
elk. That was a Montana elk.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nice. How long ago was that?
You know, I was trying to remember. It has to be about 10 or 11 years ago.
Okay.
That's awesome. That was a beautiful bull.
Oh, it was an awesome hunt. There was six of us that went out, and we ended up killing five bulls and three mule deer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yep. It was the outfitter there said that's the best group, or that the best that any group had done up until that point. But really? We'd lucked out. We'd got their opening weekend of gun season, which I think was the last weekend of October, something like that. And this outfitter leased a whole mountain. Wow. It's called Pine Mountain out there. It was awesome. Really? Yeah.
Huh. Yep. So, roughly how many acres is that?
Well, you know, it's a mountain.
Gosh, I don't know. You know? 20,000, 30,000.
Oh, man, that'd be awesome.
But it one-inch square on the map.
It was just north of the northwest entrance to Yellowstone. There's like a Paradise Valley that comes up from that, and it was just off of that valley. It was the most beautiful country I've ever seen.
Oh, it sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
A name like Paradise Valley, how could you not?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be where a lot of the movie stars have bought up most of that property out there.
Right.
So from the top of the mountain, you could look over and, well, there's so-and-so's airstrip to get to his cabin and this and that. Right. So really, if you got away from the fence around this mountain, and the three sides that I saw all had some sort of property fence, I mean, nothing elaborate. But it definitely was a marker that you did not want to get over.
Right.
They stipulated that pretty well.
A boundary you don't want to cross.
Yeah.
Imagine you took it with a rifle.
Yeah.
What caliber, if you don't mind me asking?
Remington 300 Ultra Mag.
Sweet. Nice.
That was awesome. Yep.
How far away?
Which shot?
Oh. Well, let's start at the beginning.
You see,
that's a good place
some of
to
these,
begin.
I've been on quite a few adventures, and some of them didn't quite go as expected.
Right.
And this was one of them.
Okay.
The day before opening, we'd got up there, and it was sleety, rainy, coldy. I mean, just miserable weather.
Ideal for the animal.
Yeah, and we had taken 2 days to drive out there. Mm-hmm. And got in there and wanted to shoot our rifles, you know, and make sure everything was cool before we got hunting. And, you know, everybody shot, and it was got colder and colder. And, of course, we didn't want to bring our rifles in to the tent where we had heating and stuff because we didn't want to, you know, the...
Build the condensation.
Yeah, even though they were already wet. So we kind of put them outside under a thing so that they would stay normalized and whatnot. Right. And... the thing that happens is things freeze when that does that.
Really?
So got up the next morning. Oh, well, actually, that afternoon we went out glassing, and there was 11 bulls up on the next mountain over, mm-hmm. which was, I bet it wasn't even a quarter mile from where our mountain went down and it went up.
Right.
I mean, we were fired up.
Oh, yeah.
11 bulls,
heck yeah.
You know, and there's some pretty nice ones. No cows at all. They were sparring. I mean, it was just awesome.
You got to see the elks act the way the elks act.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
So we get up the next morning and, you know, pick out. There's two people per guide, and everybody basically took a direction. Me and my guide kind of went down the middle, and then the other two groups kind of circled around. And the plan was that once those elk kind of started dissipating, you know, we would kind of try and head them off at the pass when they came on our side.
Catch them where they were going.
Yep. So we got out there in the morning and started glassing right at light. There was 21 bulls out there.
Oh,
it was unbelievable. We were sitting there in awe. And they all, ploop, went over the other side of the mountain, the opposite direction of us.
Naturally.
So,
naturally.
Yeah, so we kind of headed off into our different direction, and they weren't bugling at that time, so it was basically just kind of a spot and stalk type thing. Mm-hmm. And I had pretty much arranged this whole hunt because I had been on some elk hunts before that were miserably tough. Mm-hmm. And this hunt here, we drove to the top of the mountain in the morning and hunted down instead of the normal get down at the bottom and then hunt up.
Right.
You know, for us Michiganders hunting at that, those type of altitudes, it's killer.
The thermals go crazy, right? In the morning and
thermals and just the body. Yeah. I mean, you don't have the oxygen. No matter how hard you train here, I was doing stupid stuff like hiking with, you know, 50-pound backpacks, and we don't have hills around here.
Right.
And the oxygen to mimic that. So no matter how good a shape you are, it's tough.
You're like plugging one nostril and taking off for a 3-mile jog just to...
Oh, I was in a hunt in Alberta, and my guide was a triathlete for Calgary University.
Wow.
So we're hearing these bugling up way up high on these mountains. So we go up after him. He's got his hand in his pocket, eating sunflower seeds, blah, 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 and talking.
Right.
And I have my bow and just a light backpack, and I'm dying.
Right.
Just trying to keep up with him. I'm dying. I mean, it's just miserable.
Don't you want some more seeds? Slow down.
Well, you know, and he's trying to talk to you and keep you talking to kind of keep your rhythm and your breath and stuff as you're, you know, and all that stuff. So
get to the top with your spot and scope and it's, well, I think there's one over there.
Yeah.
I think so.
So anyway, we started up at the top and started moving down, and we were kind of following these benches down and around and just walking. He was in front of me and walking real slow, and I looked up and there was a bull staring right at us about 30 yards away, just popped right up. And he was right in front of me, so I tapped on him and he turned around, and I was like, you know, there he is right there. So that elk took off and kind of circled down below the bench and circling around to our right, and he got out his cow call, and I jumped down to get a spot to set down, and he got on that cow call, and that bull stopped in one of the only lanes that I would have been able to shoot because it was so thick in there. Broadside, about 50 or 60 yards.
Oh, wow.
I pull up, you know, thinking, you're mine, you know?
Right.
Click. My firing pin had froze, so it had slowly worked, and you could just hear it go tink, you know? And I kind of looked at it, and when I racked that shell, that bull took off again. Right. And I put another shell in, you know, because he's going, didn't you load it? And, yeah, you know, I kicked the shell out. So he got on that cow call again, and I'll be darned if that bull didn't circle back around and stop in that same lane about 120, 130 yards down there.
No kidding.
So I pulled up again, and it was like, well, here you go, and then pow!
That time it worked.
That time it worked.
It goes to show you the power of the cow call.
Yeah. Yep. You know, and that property had been hunted a little bit during archery season.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how many clients that they had had, but really no pressure at all. And that surrounding property, there was no hunting at all either. So it was really a cool spot.
It sounds like you came into like an ideal position, an ideal circumstance that you were able to capitalize to get that animal after.
Yeah.
And everybody's had moments like that where, you know, maybe you get a dud bullet. Maybe you pull the trigger and it clicks. Your firing pin works, but the bullet doesn't go off. And you got to make the decision, do I rack one in real quick and try to get a second shot on this animal? Or do I let it look at me for a minute, try to keep it, you know, let it drop its eyes away from me to real slowly do it? Or, you know, each circumstance is different.
Elk hunt, man. That's on my bucket list. I want to do it, man.
Absolutely.
It was awesome.
I heard, unfortunately, in Montana, which is one of the best places in the country to go hunt elk, I heard they just up their out-of-state prices, man. They're like $800.
I'm not surprised. I mean,
people will pay it.
Absolutely. Over-the-counter or a draw?
I think it's over-the-counter.
Because we had bought, we didn't want to try and grab a draw with six people. So they had I don't know if it was a guide thing or an outfitter thing or what, but for a bull elk and a mule deer buck tag, it was a combination at that time of like, I think it was $675, something like that.
That ain't terrible.
And that's not bad.
No,
for two out-of-state tags.
Right.
Yeah, but the or maybe it was 975. I don't know. That was a long time ago. But I know that the draw licenses were considerably cheaper.
Right.
Yeah.
For the guys that put in the time to get the points to apply for the draw.
How much of a notice do you get? When do they draw and when's the season? Like, how much of a notice do you get to plan your trip?
See, that I don't know. I know most of the draws out west are in the early springtime.
Probably like it is here, I'd imagine.
I would think so, yeah.
But I think it's June, earlier. Because a lot of the packets come out, I think, in January or maybe February. And then you got time to go through. And I just got a Cabela's thing. And it goes through all the different states and tells you when you need to have your applications in and all that. And
right.
I kind of leafed through it, but I'm not looking for a hunt like that, so I didn't pay attention to it.
Right.
If you guys want to get a headache, start flipping through the hunting guides for the western states.
The rules and regulations.
Holy shit. Well, there's so many species.
Right.
Yeah. Antelope, mule deer, white-tailed deer,
and
elk.
Every state is different. Every state, and in fact, in some states, different DMUs.
Different zones are different. Yeah.
So you really have to stay on. It is the hunter's responsibility to know all the game laws and all the applicable, you know, the things that you can and can't do. So if you're going to plan a trip like that, make sure you spend some time studying where you're going, the area that you're going to be in, talk to some people from that area if you can, and just make sure you brush up on all the local rules and regulations, because the last thing you want to do is drive that far, pay that much money, go out with good intentions, and then find out at the end of it all that you did something wrong and you don't get to enjoy the bounty that you've harvested. You know, you stay legal.
I don't want to sound like I'm an expert or anything, because I've never done any out-of-state hunting or destination hunts like that.
Certainly nothing illegal. Tactical Error, episode 4.
Episode 10.
10?
Yeah, you guys can hear all about that one. But I do know, like, a lot of these states, I think you have to actually take their hunter safety course before you go.
Okay.
Or and if you were born before a certain time or after a certain time, most of them will honor Michigan's if you have your hunter safety certificate.
Right. You get,
but you have to have that in order to get the license there.
Shit, I don't even know where my certificate would be. 'Cause it's been
the last time I hunted in Missouri, my partner, who was, he's probably in his 30s, he didn't bring his with him. And we had bow hunted for their last archery week before their gun season started, and had been seeing so many bucks that we decided to stay for the first couple days of their gun season, and went and buy our tags, and I'm way over the limit, so I didn't have to worry about it.
Right.
But he couldn't buy his license because he forgot his
hunter safety certificate.
So didn't have the number or anything like that.
I was going to say, for mine, I don't have my hunter safety certificate anymore that I know of, but I always use an old tag. As long as I have like a tag that has my license number on it. Yeah.
But you can go, and I don't even remember where I went, but I think it was our Montana hunt. I actually got a hold of the DNR,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to find it from back in the Stone Age when I took that.
Really?
Yeah. I actually took it at our high school.
Back really?
When the hunter's safety.
Back when things were right.
I actually took mine in junior high.
Did you?
At Ringlardner Junior High for an elective. They actually had a class that you could take.
Safety guns course. In yes. the school. Can you imagine that?
Calm
Nobody
down.
Died.
Hang on a second.
Nobody
Pump
got
the
hurt.
Pump the brakes yeah. here. Let's slow it down.
Yeah.
Hold on, Snowflake.
And, you know, a lot of times I think that if we had things like that nowadays, we wouldn't have the trouble that we have, which is a totally different episode. Not going to get too far into that, but if parents would take the time to teach their children the respect of owning a firearm, of caring for a firearm, and of discharging a firearm, we wouldn't have kids watching all these movies and playing all these video games and whatever else you want to attribute it to, going in with a gun and shooting up places like that, because they would have more respect for themselves, the equipment that they're handling, and for everybody around them if they just had a parent or had a role model that gave a damn about what they were doing.
Well,
that gave a damn about proper technique. And teaching kids to respect the power and the privilege that comes with shooting a firearm.
Respect it.
Yeah. That's.
I got hats off to Iowa, because one of the school systems over there implemented the hunter safety program into their curriculum.
Which is, to me, it's mind-blowing. I hear my dad talk about, like, when he was in school, when they took physical education, they would shoot bow and arrow. Mm-hmm. They would have air rifles that they would shoot. They would have rifle, you know.
Yep.
It wasn't uncommon for everybody to have to participate in this sport of shooting things. And the people that didn't like it would complain about it, do it, and then get away from doing it. But the people that did like it were able to learn in a safe environment the proper way to do this stuff.
Shit, when my dad was in high school, he would take his gun with him to school because he would go from high school to go hunt squirrels at the trap line or
every
whatever.
Every day, yeah, we did that. We'd check traps before school, you know, have our guns in the case. They'd be in the case, but they'd be laying in the truck somewhere or whatever.
Right, right.
It wasn't, nobody got hurt.
So that's a good segue. How long you been trapping, man?
I probably started when I was 12-ish. So that would have been around 74, 75, somewhere around there.
And the fur prices were pretty damn good back then, weren't they?
Yeah.
Now, what did you start trapping? Just coyotes? Beaver?
I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations is over by now. There was an internet. You basically had to get like the Firefox, I think they were called, series, or Firefly. There's a whole series of outdoor books.
Okay.
I have them somewhere at home, but I haven't looked at them in a long time. But they showed you how to make survival snares and whatnot and things to use, and I would snare rabbits in the yard.
Oh, no shit.
Oh, yeah. You know, we lived, our backyard butted up to the city limit of Buchanan. So,
refills.
So, yeah, I mean, it was not country, but in our neighborhood that we lived in, nobody really said anything about it. Right. So,
well, snares are quiet. That's a good thing.
Well, a rabbit with a snare around his neck isn't. So,
yeah, this is true. This is true.
Well, you can't. Can you snare for rabbits? Because you got to have a 4 1/4.
I don't think legally.
Yeah, you got to have a 4 1/4 stopper, right? And that wouldn't be enough to kill.
Well, that's
a rabbit.
Only for coyotes and fox.
Right.
That's the only thing. Beaver and otter you can snare, but there's no stop. Loop stop for that.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But that's those, usually because you can only use in the water.
Exactly. Those are in the water where they're not going to take a chance of getting some other animal trapped up, wrapped up in them or whatever. And those are usually set small enough that if the odd chance that a deer got in the water and got around one of those snares, there's no way they're going to be able to fit their head through there or anything like that. Right? No? Okay. I mean,
well, for a beaver, you use about a 10-inch loop.
Okay.
And for land snaring coyotes, you're probably looking at a 12 to 15-inch loop. So,
because I've seen... Yeah,
the 10-inch loop is, you know, way big enough for a deer, but...
I've heard stories about guys trapping coyotes without going too deep into specifics, where the stop on the snare didn't exactly work the way it should have. A doe got caught one time.
Didn't have it down tight enough or something?
No, I don't.
We should just real quick describe what a stop is. What we're talking about is just a little nut that's on the snare itself, which is basically a wire cable.
So a snare is like an 1/8-inch cable, or maybe
5/64. You can use anything over a 1/16-inch in Michigan.
It's a smaller cable. Is it usually coated with some sort of?
No, it's just a galvanized aircraft cable, basically. Okay.
And the stop on that is a crimped on piece of a steel or piece of lead or whatever that will stop the snare from closing up too tightly.
All the way.
Yeah.
Right, around
4 1/4 inch is the legal size for our.
And they do do that for deer, right? So if they get their legs caught in it, they don't get their legs cut or caught. But if they still get their head caught, they're gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot, you know, and I don't know how deep we want to get into this, but from what I understand, a lot of this was derived from the
running dog associations
of Michigan when these cable restraint laws went into effect.
Right.
Those
guys wouldn't want to get their dogs caught in the snares.
Yeah.
Because you can't even start snaring in Michigan until what?
January 1st.
Yeah. And you could foothold all year long, right? Technically, if you wanted to.
It depends on how you look at the law. I mean, you can basically take coyotes 365 if they're doing or about to do damage. And I've heard different things from the DNR. That may be a question to ask, but it seems like people that have asked, everybody has a little bit different opinion of when actual trapping season starts and stops as opposed to the year-round hunting of them.
Right.
So,
because I know if it's a nuisance, you can get like a nuisance license for farms or whatever, and you will have the ability to take as many animals as necessary to...
Well, for Michigan, I think you really need a base tag, I think. Even if they're nuisance, right?
Okay. That started, I believe, last year, year before last. Right.
Okay.
I think before you were right? You could get a
nuisance tag. A nuisance kill tag, and that gave, or a nuisance permit, and that gave you the ability to harvest as many animals as deemed necessary by the landowner to stop the pervasive destruction of cropland, just property in general, or livestock. Livestock decimation was a big thing, so...
That was the doing or about to do damage thing that they always had in their book.
But, I mean, you trappers don't even want to start getting out there until October or November, right? When they're starting to come in the prime?
Yeah, generally, the first week of November is a pretty safe start. You know, it's all, their fur primes, kind of like the deer going into rut, you know, it's all light activative thing.
Yeah,
The leaves and all that. It's all kind of based on that. It doesn't matter really the weather because... You look at the southern states and whatnot, and, you know, their fur actually primes up also.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, Alabama and Georgia and all that. But as you get into northern latitudes, you get better fur because of that, and especially out west in Montana and North and South Dakota.
Where they have the harsher, cold climate. Yeah.
And their coyotes actually have fur instead of coarse hair like ours does.
Yeah.
So how'd you do last season?
I think I ended last year with 58 coyotes and I believe 17 fox. I really don't even know how many muskrat, and I got 2 mink, and
That's a very respectable number. That's a lot of coyotes.
Yeah.
Between him and Chuck, that's what last year they were, we can account for 120, 130 some coyotes taken out of the city.
You
know what?
In this area, if you guys are a coyote, you really don't stand a chance. So you just might as well move on because we got some real talented guys here that do a lot of good work to help out.
So we're friends on Facebook, and eventually, I saw you post a couple pictures of some like darker colored coyotes. I think we actually had a conversation about domestic in the pedigree somewhere, actually.
Yeah, about the coy dog thing and all that. Yeah, you know, and I read up a little bit on that, as much information that I can find. You know, there's a lot of people claiming this and claiming that, but if you look into the hard evidence of the genetics and stuff like that that has been done, that it doesn't appear to be, from what I can find, a viable thing. The coy dogs and coy wolves and all that, you know, it probably does happen, but genetic wise they can't really say that it's going to work very well.
Right. And you'd be hard pressed to find an official with any particular amount of clout behind them to say that there is such a thing as a proven coy dog or whatever.
Right.
Just because it's so hard, it's so easy to speculate, but it's so hard to prove.
It's complicated. Even when we talked to Kevin Swanson, he's a biologist. I mean, that's what he is, a predator biologist, and he didn't even want to talk about it.
Right.
Well, before we got him on the show, he sent me an email. He's like, I'd rather not. He's like, there's just way too much speculation.
Right. There's too many little variances in there that can make it.
Genetic-wise, I mean, they're finding things for a lot of years back, you know, hundreds of years, genetics have evolved through us, them, everything. So there may be a speck of this from
way
one
back
time that is in there. And how do you justify that as
Right. An actual koi dog, just because it's got a little bit of domestic from way back in its pedigree. Yeah.
You know, I had told you, I believe, when I bought my lab from a breeder down in southern Indiana, she had, when she bought a male or female to use for parents, she would have them genetically tested, because the results of those tests she could put together to make sure that she got the silvers and the charcoals and separate those from the chocolates and the blacks and the yellows. So she basically had groups that she kept together because they put out these certain colors.
And that's what I was going to get, because you had those darker coyotes, and that you said it was one certain property that you trapped that has those, right? And then, like, up at my parents' house, they have a lot of red fays. Mm-hmm. You think it's just that? They're just, that's there, and it started, and they just keep breeding, and that's just what it is?
Right.
No rhyme or reason, it's just...
Right.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Yeah, and I'm in 5 days, I caught... 13 coyotes off of that one property, and there was a great big blonde female and a great big normal, I would say, colored, you know, coyote male, and I believe all the rest were pups. So I don't know if those two were the parents, you know, that blonde female maybe in hers, or I don't know, but I haven't seen that type around here besides those ones that are
pretty dogs, man.
Oh, they're pretty
real
cool.
Pretty.
Yeah.
How do you get, because we talked with Chuck and he said the pale coyotes are what bring in the most money at market.
Right.
Yeah.
Are these worth any less? Those darker ones that you
if you were to send those to the Canadian auction, they wouldn't sell worth a crap.
Hmm.
You have to find alternative markets.
Like a local buyer?
Like taxidermists, specialty markets, and things like that.
Huh.
Yep. Those pay really good money.
For all coyotes, not even just the dark or the red phase.
A lot of them look for those special color phases.
So where do you send your furs to when you get them? What is your process for... Do you use a local fur harvester, or do you international send it to Canada, or how do you do...
You know... Up until last year, I had always waited until after deer season, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't start trapping until January, because I actually got back into it about probably 8 years ago now, after being away from it because of life and everything else.
Right.
And
it's time-consuming for sure.
And, you know, I wanted something to do that time of year besides ice fishing, because Lord knows our ice is iffy as it
yeah,
is.
Right.
So trapping in January and February, you probably get 30 to 50% bad to begin with because of
the rubs,
the mange, the lice, you know, all that. So what was left, I would just have tanned and... either keep them or sell them or give them to gifts or whatever.
Right.
So last year was my first year of starting early and just going for it. And found a really good buyer over this side of Battle Creek. And I can't think of the name of the little bird, but he's out in the country there. Trevor Barnes, Hide and Fur. He actually came up to a coyote hunt in Dwajak that they had.
Oh, I heard it. Yeah.
The one that... Hale's Hardware puts on.
Oh, yeah.
He was there buying furs.
From no shit.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's I talked to him during that, and seemed like a great guy. So I took a sample. I think I took 30 of them up there, coyotes, just to try out. I think I took my red fox also that I had at that time, and it was a week before the first international auction, which is... I think it was like the first or second week in February.
Okay.
And he was great. I mean, he paid me a lot more money for my red fox than I had heard was going, you know, the going rate.
Going rate, right.
And did really good on my coyotes, so...
cool. That's...
I took a lot more fur to him later in the season, but I did ship some to NAFTA to try out up in Canada.
Right.
And to this day, I still have all the red fox that I sent setting up there and part of my raccoons still sitting there that didn't sell because the prices were so bad. They have some kind of reserve that they set, and they will not sell them if it goes below that reserve, which is cool, but who knows how long they could set there.
Right.
So, and till the auctions start, the international auctions start, it's kind of a guessing game for everybody on what the fur market is going to do, because it's all the international buyers that drive this whole thing. So it's all speculation until then. Like my red fox, I think he gave me $22.50 for him. And after that first auction, his prices dropped down like $10 a piece because they didn't sell at the auctions. You know, it's kind of like playing the stock market, trying to figure out what to do with these.
You got to find out what people want. Like, is there a particular country that buys more furs, or is it just luck of the draw? You don't know what you're getting into when you go up there.
They're always searching for buyers, and they're going to different countries and pitching their spiel, and they try and get as much influx as they can to, of course, the more buyers, generally the better off the prices are going to be.
It's the free market. More competition in the buyer market means that you get a better price when you're trying to sell. So
I would like to think that most of you guys don't do it for the money, though.
If you put it down on paper, red and black,
it
would be ugly.
Yeah.
It would be very ugly.
Stay a lot in the red.
It's so labor intensive. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's a huge profit at the end. It's just do it because you love it, right?
Yeah. You know, and you can't depreciate your mileage or your truck repair costs or anything. Right, so
all that stuff adds up.
Yeah. So, I look at it as that you can buy some more traps the next year and not pay out of my pocket and whatever.
You made enough money to buy yourself a cup of coffee on the way to check your trap line.
I was able to put a new roof on what is now my fur shed and totally gut it and insulate it and make it actually a nice warm fur shed this year. So
awesome.
Little things like that.
Also this year, you caught yourself a bobcat, didn't you?
Yeah.
Dude, that's awesome. That is so awesome. So where I was confused, I thought you caught it locally. We're in, most of you know, southwest lower Michigan, like right by the Indiana border.
Well, we're in the south. West corner of Michigan.
Y'all.
So I thought you caught it somewhere here locally, but you said you can't even trap them down here. You got to go up by the rifle line, which is about the middle of the mitten. For those of you who know, right about the middle of the mitten is my rifle line. It's north of that.
Yeah.
And the UP.
Yep. And there's several different zones, like in the Lake Mason County area, and I don't remember what two counties are above that. They're broken up into zones B and C and D and E for some reason, and I don't know why that is, because they all have the same seasons and the same regulations.
Right.
Until you get up into Zone A, which is the basically the entire UP, except for Drummond Island.
And they let you take two in the UP, or if you take one in the lower peninsula, you can take another one in the upper peninsula.
The only way you can take two is the second one has to be private land in Zone A, which is the UP.
The UP, but it's got to be private land.
It's got to be private land.
And just to backtrack a little bit, those of you who might be in San Jose listening, you don't know what a rifle line is. In the state of Michigan, we have it set up where in the lower half of the lower peninsula, you're not allowed to hunt with a centerfire rifle that is over a certain caliber for deer. And once you get a little bit farther up north, you have the ability to actually hunt with like a .30-06 270, a 223.
Yeah.
Lower calibers like that.
Because of the population density.
Right.
Which to me doesn't make a whole lot of sense because you can hunt with an inline muzzleloader down here, which shoots just as far as a rifle.
Yeah.
And you can hunt coyotes with high-powered center fires, can't you?
Well, yeah, you can. At night, in fact. Exactly. We don't want to get too far into it. I'm just, for the purpose of explaining what you just said, the rifle line is that imaginary line on a particular area where legally, we're not allowed to use a particular firearm, a particular rifle firearm, south of this line in the state of Michigan. So,
which, like I said, is right about the middle of the mitten.
Right. Yeah. Pretty well cuts right across the kind of where the thumb starts.
What's that, like north of Grand Rapids, maybe?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Somewhere around there.
Right in that area.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
I mean, I started this whole thing back probably last spring. After trapping season, when I got bored, I got to thinking about. I've always liked bobcats. Yeah. You know, I bought a Western one and have it hanging, really cool. I think that one, the CITES tag, is from Washington or Oregon or somewhere out there.
What's a CITES tag? Will you grab me a beer, Adam, please.
It's a seal that they put on it for bear, the bobcat, otter, fisher, marten.
Just to let you know where it comes from and who harvested it, or just
I don't know the background of positive identification on the animal
that you're buying.
You can't really do anything with that pelt unless it's got that seal on it,
right?
And it's like the old time deer tags, you know, the metal ones that they used to have where it clipped on.
Oh yeah, it wouldn't come off.
Well, now they're plastic. But it's the same type of situation.
Oh, okay.
But you actually, after you get your fur harvester's license, you can get your two bobcat tags, your Fisher Martin tag, and your otter tag for free, which you have to have. So when you harvest one of those animals, same as a deer, before you do anything with it, before you move it,
you have to put this
temporary tag on. And that stays, and then you have so many days to go to a DNR office to have them take the, in the bobcat case and a lot of these others, they take the whole skull and send it in for evaluation, and then they put this seal on it. And,
really? Wow.
Yeah. Yep.
So how long does it take you to like flesh out a coyote? What is, do you have a standard time for that, or is it just dependent on
the actual skinning? I have a pretty cool setup with the electric winch.
Do you do like the golf ball and the hide with the winch, and are you just
I have a eye bolt in the floor,
right,
with a 1/8-inch cable, with a movable loop on it, and once I get that hide started, I just run that winch down and grab a hold of it with that at the, like the base of the tail up on the hide,
right,
and just rip it all the way down to the armpits and take a bar, rip the legs out, pull it back up until it gets to the ears, and then cut the face out of it. It's like, when I'm on a roll, it's like 12 minutes.
Nice.
Something like
nice.
That.
Damn, dude.
That's pretty quick, yeah.
Well, you have to. I mean, the first,
me forever,
first 4.5 weeks of season, I caught 57.
Wow.
So if you divide that per night, you know, average, that's a lot of humping.
Even if it's 10 minutes an animal, that's a lot of work.
Yeah,
that's a lot of work.
And then you get, and then you throw it on a beam and flesh it.
Right.
And most of them, you know, I've got a really good steel that I use for that. It's maybe 10 minutes to do that.
That's not bad.
And I built a tumbler this year that I wash all the furs after I get them fleshed.
Really?
And then put them in this tumbler, which uses like a corn cob grit.
Uh-huh.
And you put that and borax in there and then tumble it. And it really makes the fur pop.
Nice.
I don't know if it's going to get any more money because...
It just makes it look good, though.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make a...
Well, here's racks,
ass
racks for feathers,
whatever they call it.
Bringing you a solid tip here is that I've heard of guys with the winch, the eye bolt on the floor on the winch, and what they'll do is they'll start their animal and they'll put a golf ball under the skin and they'll just do that for something to wrap the cable around. Then they'll use the winch to pull that up.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like you do it the same way, just without that.
Well, that works with a deer hide,
mm-hmm.
but if you were to try that on a small area like that on a coyote, you probably rip that whole area out of there. So you have to have a pretty good ball of heavy,
pretty good
like
bunches.
Back fur or back hide, you know, the thicker parts of it,
right?
In order for it, because there's a lot of strain when you get that thing when you start moving over the chest and into right. the arm area. I mean, my rafters in my barn are creaking a lot of times. You get some of those big old males and older females, and they just don't come off of there very well.
And you're probably like the rest of us. You don't get to take the animal right out of the field when it's hot, take it back and skin it right away. This is after it sat in your truck for a while. Maybe it got frozen, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
And then you
well,
bring
if you snare
it inside.
They've been sitting out there dead for
exactly.
hours.
Exactly. And then you got to thaw it out a little bit before you do it. And it's a whole process, but it.
I do my best to skin it that same day because when they're warm, they generally skin a lot easier.
And it's a labor of love no matter what you're doing. If you get into the trapping profession, if you're going to be serious about it, you know that it's going to take you a lot of time to do it. You know that you want to use your best practices to get it done as fast and as efficiently as you can. But at the same time, it's going to take the time that it takes.
Yep.
You know, it's something that you just got to be ready to do.
You know, and through the whole process from trapping to setting up properties, everything, I try and do it as efficiently as possible.
Right, right.
Even though it's not a business, I try and, in my head, run it more like a business would be run to
Absolutely.
Be as efficient as possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have a property that somebody wants you to trap over here. I've got a big map on my wall of Berrien Cass, Van Buren County, and I have all the properties outlined, and I started doing that this summer, and then, okay, I know I need to go here, here, and here. Well, I started filling in between there. So instead of driving 10 miles to go to this property and only have checks there, maybe every 3 miles I would find another farm and then work my way and have big loops set up. East and west and south and not too much north, but
kind of like a paper delivery boy to make it a simple analogy, where you have a route that you follow and you want to maximize the time that you spend on the route collecting the animals that you can collect when you can.
Mm-hmm.
So you would fill in the gaps between, you know, if you got a farm that's 30 miles away, like you said, you want to find something in between that to kind of help supplement the drive time to give you something to do instead of
the
just,
more animals you catch. In that mileage, the more profitable
exactly.
you're going
to
be.
Yep.
So,
back to the bobcat thing. You said you get a bobcat tag free with your harvester license?
Yes, the temporary tag.
Okay. Now, to actually harvest a bobcat, is how does that work? Is it a drawing?
Or no, is it over you the just counter? Have to have your
just,
fur harvester's
just,
license.
That's it?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yep.
And that's what, $15, $20, something like that.
I don't even know what it was. $17.
Chump change. It's not much.
Well, I usually spend $100
right.
bucks every time, so it's, right. you know, you don't look at all that.
See,
stuff.
I was under the impression you needed an actual
no
bobcat harvesting tag.
When you buy your base license, no. and then you buy your fur harvester license, and you buy your fishing license, and
yeah.
then you buy, you know, all
yeah.
at the same
and,
time.
And you used to be able to get a discount when you bought all those, and I don't know if you do that anymore or not.
I don't
but,
think so.
I mean,
I think
it's like you need them, so you buy them and
right.
be done with it.
Exactly.
You know?
It's better to spend a little bit of money on it initially and be legal and not have to worry about it than to worry about,
oh, God, yes.
Am I legal? You know, do I need to worry about getting a license to do this? If you can afford it and you got the money, spend the money. If you don't use it, the money's going to good use. It's going back into our state. It's going back into conservation programs that we can all appreciate. You know, the reason we have a bobcat season right now is because the DNR have set up the conservation program to allow the bobcat to come into our area and flourish. You know, we're not by any means over trapping them, but there's not a lot of them to trap to begin with. So,
well, there's it kind of is mirroring what they did with the bear.
Mm-hmm.
I think back in 2000 is when they finally started monitoring and limiting the bear permits,
right.
cuz up until then it was basically a free for all,
right.
and you could use your firearm deer license if you had that, you could shoot a bear,
really,
you know, things like that, and they really had no clue how many we had.
Huh.
And so they started this monitoring system, and they had a biologist set up that ran it for years. I don't know if he still does or not, but I had a place up in the Western UP, and I had talked to this guy several times. Great guy, had just a ton of information, and he went through and explained and how they set quotas for all the different areas, and a lot of it was population density and nuisance calls. That's how some of that was driven.
You know, I wonder if it wasn't Kevin Swanson I was just talking to.
Because I don't know how many times we're going to mention him in this episode.
Right, well, he's a very important man, but he would have been the one that like...
He was the one that talked to the, what they call it, the committee, the NRC, national.
Right. To the best of our knowledge, he was the one that had a lot of swing and a lot of pull when it comes to deciding what the quota limits were. So he would be the one that would be the most knowledgeable on population density in a certain part of the UP, because he would get the calls about the nuisances and things like that.
Right.
He was the guy that would lobby for more tags or less tags depending on the activity that he was seeing in his day-to-day job, you know, doing what he does. So that's interesting.
What I thought was interesting is I got some information from the DNR that the average bobcat harvest in Michigan is usually like 680 every year.
What?
Which, yeah, surprised the shit out of me.
I don't know what percentage is, but it's really low if you start looking at all the data that's collected.
Yeah.
I didn't know bobcats were so prevalent, I guess.
But yeah, there's actually a lot of people in the mid-northern part of the state that stop coyote trapping after a while because they get so tired of releasing bobcats.
No,
I
bet
that's they're a pain in the ass.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
You know, I mean...
I'd hate to walk up on a trap, have a bobcat in the trap. Well, what do you do now?
Yeah,
just back out and act like you never saw it. Nah, I don't know if that works. I don't.
But I was really surprised.
Give me some catnip.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I mean, that seemed like a kind of a high number to me too.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't.
If you look at the somewhere in the DNR site, there's data that they've collected over the years, because of this check-in system that they have, and it goes through. It goes through the predator gun hunting, the trapping portion of it, and then it has it combined, and it goes county to county, area to area, how many have harvested, how many were released.
Right.
You know, because apparently they, if you have a permit or a tag, you have to fill out a survey later that talks about where you harvested or how many days you had. I mean, they asked me how many traps I had out,
right,
how many days I was there, and if I released any or not. So they take all this data, and it's all there to view for the different years.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's how I picked this. One of the reasons I picked this area was because it had one of the higher harvest data.
The success rate or whatever.
Yeah, the success rate, plus one of the higher release rates also.
So you knew there was plentiful bobcat in that area.
Yeah.
It's like when I was, not to change the subject, when I was hunting in Canada, the one time I went for black bear, at the end of my hunt, my guide had me fill out a questionnaire, and I was required to actually say how many black bears I saw. Not how many bears I saw when I was in the stand, not how many bears I could have shot while I was in the stand, how many black bears I actually saw in the woods, and that number was, you know, 8 or 9, whatever it was. Is way bigger than the one that I saw when it actually harvested, but they use that information like, there's that many bear in this area.
Right.
They just want to know what you can see, because obviously they can't be out there all the time. They don't set trail cams to monitor a population for animals, so they rely on the public input, the people that are out there in the field doing it, to be honest and be, you know, forthcoming with the information that they have coming out of the woods, to let everybody else know potentially what the limit could be for the next year, the next season. Because if you're seeing a lot of animals, it's not about what you harvest necessarily. It's about what you see when you're in the woods, because there's a potential for somebody to come behind you and capitalize on what you, if you fill your tag, if you fill your quota, somebody might want to come behind you and do the same thing. So they want to know all that information pertinent to what they're going to allow people to harvest. So
now, how long ago was that?
It was, I think, 2014.
Okay.
Up in Nipigon.
Because back in the early 80s, I had went up to Ontario this was before they had shut down their spring season, and it was $50 for a tag, and you could basically buy as many tags as you wanted. I mean, it was a free-for-all for black bear at that time.
That's crazy.
They wanted the tourism, and I mean, yeah, this outfitter that we went to, which was right outside the, I think the Algonquin Provincial Park, I think that's where it was, but
okay.
This outfitter went in there and wiped the bears out.
Oh,
I mean, just devastated them. Because it was nobody knew that much about bears
back
then.
Right, right.
And it was shortly after that when they totally shut down their spring season because they had decimated the bears in Ontario, basically. And I think just a few years ago, they opened the spring season back up again. And the tag prices are, what, $500?
I can tell you when I was up there, I think I've talked about it before, if I didn't pay $350, I paid $450 for an out of province, whatever, bear tag when I was up there. And we were there for a week, and it was probably, I think out of my pocket, I spent just under $2,000. That's in, like, gas for the truck, gas for the four-wheelers driving up there. The tag price was one of the most significant items that we spent money on because it was a lot of money to harvest a bear, and I didn't get a big bear by any means, but I damn sure wasn't going home without one when I paid that much for a tag, so.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's really not that outrageous of money, though.
Right.
I mean, you look at Michigan, I don't remember how much our tag is anymore, but there's areas where it's 10, 15, 18 years to draw a tag.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, you can save up $2,000 in just in a slush fund in no time at all, as opposed to waiting 18 years to try for a 20% chance of killing a bear in Michigan.
And that's something we've talked about before, too. When you guys do go to buy your tags, it's a simple thing to say, I'd like to spend $5 on a bear point, you know, it. You might not use it this year. You might not use
exactly.
It
I tell people
year.
That all the time.
But to have those points under your name is almost, you know, like the money you spend on them, you're not even going to ever worry about because it's so invaluable to have that ability to draw a tag if you need one, if you want one, you know, just to have 4, 5, 6, 10 points saved up. So
this bobcat. So since you caught it so far away, was there any scouting or you just went up and set for cats?
I really...
It's a two-part question because I'm going to ask you how you set for a cat.
I kind of figured that was coming, but I really don't know anything about bobcats besides, you know, reading on the internet and forums and things like that.
I run a bobcat every day at work.
but I do have a video, this Bernie Behringer, I think his name, a dude from Minnesota, made this bobcat and coyote winter snaring video. And I bought that several years ago. He had made the video, and he was just getting it all set. Didn't even have any of them done yet. But he was running a promotion, and... there's, I think, so many dollars of it was going to some fund, and it wasn't very expensive because of this whole thing. So I bought one just to check it out, you know, winter snaring, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And it was really a pretty cool video just to watch, even though the Minnesota laws, I don't think it was, it was Minnesota where they were doing it. So their laws, snaring laws, rules, everything is way different than ours.
Right.
But it was cool to see the setups. And one of the things that he talked about in there was the age structure of the forest where they look for bobcats.
Really?
So, boom, up there to the North Country I go. And it just so happened that the Thursday night and Friday morning before I got there Friday night, they had 3 to 6 inches of fresh snow. I mean, it was perfect. You know, as far as going up and saying, oh, this looks like a caddy spot, I have no clue what a caddy spot is.
Right, right.
You know, and the more I talk to people about this before, during, and after, the animals up there are not like the animals down here, whether it be the deer, the cats, the coyotes. They don't have the food sources that we have down here.
Right.
So they may come through an area and you'll see fresh tracks, but they may not be there in the duration of our 10-day season again.
Right.
Because they're out making a loop or whatever.
Excuse me.
So all I had to go by was tracks. So I hopped in my truck. I take my dog everywhere with me. You know, he was up there. I found a cheap motel to stay at. And, you know, he had one right. bed and I had the other.
But there you go.
That Saturday and Sunday from daylight until dark, we were driving forest roads, you know, the unimproved roads or seasonal roads and whatnot, looking for tracks. And I started by looking all the time, and especially around where river systems and drainages and things like that were, and of course keeping an eye on what was private land and what was national forest and whatnot. Right. And everywhere that I did find tracks mimicked what that video had said about
really?
The ages of the forest.
Hmm.
Thick cover and food. That's what they're looking for.
Then their food would be small rodents.
Rabbits, grouse, you know, things like that. So anywhere where you found that was cut maybe 10 or 15 years ago that's thick as snot right now,
right.
those are the areas where you found the tracks. So I took and I ended up finding 7 different tracks in the 2 days. And I had 2 friends from Ludington area who, it's a long story, but they found tracks after I prodded them enough to look
right.
when they were hunting.
Right.
And sure enough, both of their properties had fresh cat tracks on
nice.
Them.
Nice.
So
oh, shit.
Opening day, which was Monday, I spent all day. I set those 2 private properties and the rest all National Forest properties. And actually, one of the properties that I had checked Saturday had a fresh track Monday, and one of the properties Sunday had a fresh track Monday. So there was 2 areas that had
active.
Multiple tracks over the 3-day period. Not that it helped me any, but it was a good sign anyway.
See, when I hear you say that, you're like, you're looking for catty areas, I just throw a litter box out the back door. Come on, Pat.
Well, you know, and that's what a lot of people use is the urine and the domestic cat poop.
Right.
Really?
Because it's
cat almost poop. Basically the same.
It's cat.
Feline.
You know?
Right.
They act
Makes
like
sense.
A cat and
walk, talk.
They are a cat. Yeah.
So that's a... So what's your actual set look like? Is it different than the coyote set?
Just a
deep hole and
a foot snare?
I used a minimum of 3 different sets at every location. One, I'd do the same thing as I do for a coyote. I'd throw a great big deep dirt hole in there, you know, big flashy dirt flying all over. But the only thing different is I would throw some feathers around it and have better guiding.
Oh.
Coyotes, you can't guide because it freaks them out.
Right.
I mean, coyotes are scared to death.
When you're talking about guiding, you're talking about like using sticks to get them to separate
sticks,
one of the steps?
Rocks, you know, cubbies, things like that.
Because coyotes typically won't step on a stick, right?
They say.
Oh, Vicky brought us some pizza.
Oh my God, she's an angel.
Thank you, lady.
But yeah, I mean, like a cubby, you can basically take sticks and build like a teepee type setup and throw a beaver back there or a muskrat, and that cat has no problem walking into that.
Right.
You try to get a coyote into something like that, and
which is weird because you always hear about cats being the more wary adversary, whereas in this particular circumstance, the dogs are the ones that are a lot more careful about where they're going, what they're stepping on, what they're eating, what they're getting themselves into. And the cat, as you're explaining, just tends to wander right in.
But curiosity killed the cat, not the coyote.
Yeah. Well, that's why they say that, see?
This whole coyote thing, I perceive them more as scared than smart.
Right.
I mean, there's a story about a person that had a pet coyote in the house. The wife went in and rearranged the whole living room. You know, moved furniture, did this. That coyote would not go into that living room for 2 months after that.
Holy shit.
Because it was freaked out about the change.
It was different.
Yeah. And I tend to relate that to what I see in the field as far as what a coyote will do and won't do.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, if you do that with a domestic dog, they don't give a shit.
No.
And at what little shit they would give disappears as soon as you call their name and, you know, get them inside. But that's the difference between...
That shows the intelligence, you know?
Exactly. Breeding domestic versus having an animal in the wild. Like, people think that when their dog gets out at night, if their dog just stays out, oh, my dog will be fine. It's big. It's whatever. With coyotes in particular, you're dealing with an animal that only knows how to kill. Coyotes aren't famous for letting things go. Coyotes are famous for destroying things, killing things, and hunting for a living because that's how they survive. So to talk about how wary they are versus a cat, that's just the way that they get along in their pack mentality.
The pack thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's all about the species preservation in their mind, whereas a bobcat will be a solitary animal, right?
They tend to not necessarily
pack up, but they operate on their own in the wild, and that's kind of the mentality you have to take pursuing them.
Yeah, so if you had to give somebody some advice, if they were going out for a bobcat next year or whatever, what's any advice you could give to them? What size trap?
Any coyote trap will work. I had taken two different sizes. I use Kendall Obermeyer makes a no BS extreme and an extreme junior. The extreme is like a 6 and 6.5 inch roughly jaw spread. The other one's roughly a 5.5. If I was to do it again, I would take the smaller one and use that, because the cat that I caught, it caught it so high up and it actually caught it where the lugs are that actually keeps the jaws separated,
mm-hmm.
and it broke that bone right there.
Right. Oh.
So if I did want to release it,
it had a broken arm.
Yeah, I mean, once I saw that, it was a no-brainer. I had to do it.
Right.
But being my first cat, you know, and my friend was there with me, and we're looking at it, and he's like, that looks like a big cat to me. And I'm looking at it going, well, I don't know how big a cat's supposed to be.
Right.
And this thing's trying to eat us, and... You know, you want to do the right thing, so I put a loop around its head and flipped it over, and I saw it was a female, and I thought, man, I need to release this thing. But then when I looked at what was going on with the leg, I knew that I couldn't do that. Took that all out of the equation. Would I have? I don't know. That it was such a tough call. And
so how much did it weigh?
A big tom will be 20, 25, maybe 30 pounds, but a 20-pounder is a pretty big cat.
Now, that being said, a 20-pound bobcat's not like a 20-pound house cat. A 20-pound bobcat is 100% 20 pounds, piss, vinegar, fight, screaming, yelling, you know, clawing, scratching. It's not something you want to just walk up on and pet like a cat.
Oh, Lord, no.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have seen any of those videos where they've released them before, but...
I watched a lot on the wolves. I haven't watched many on the podcast.
They're not vicious. Nice.
No, they're not. Especially not if you break one's arm.
But congratulations on that, man. That's awesome. Sounds like you just went up there and did the damn thing.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool experience.
That's amazing.
Next year, if I decide to do it again, I probably go up a week or two ahead of time with a bunch of beaver carcasses or whatever, and
some trail cams and
pre-bait some areas,
do some scouting, and
you know, just keep them in the area. If they have food there, they're more likely to stay closer to there.
Right.
So maybe they have maybe a 4-day loop because they know there's food there instead of a 20-day loop or 15 or however long it is. So
I wonder what a bobcat, what the range on that would be. Just do they always move?
No idea.
Or
Kevin Swanson would know.
The internet. Hopefully the internet knows. If you guys want to, anybody has
somebody
knowledge.
Somebody chime in.
Yeah.
Well, we can wrap this thing up. We've been going for a while. I got to piss. So,
well, sir.
Cut.
When nature calls,
time to cut.
That's right.
But no, seriously, we've been going for well over an hour.
I feel like this is a really good episode.
Oh, no kidding. Doesn't seem like
packed,
an hour.
Yeah, packed full of information. And
we thank you for coming on, man. That's
absolutely
awesome. Awesome.
Cool.
Like, yeah, we actually tried to have him on when we had Chuck on the first time, I think it was.
Yep.
You weren't feeling well, so you didn't make it, but
wasn't feeling good today either, like I told you.
Well, we appreciate it, man. I mean, just sharing your knowledge, and we'll definitely have you back on.
Yeah, it's fun.
If you,
I got more stories too. One bullet bear. I mean,
that's what we're after. If you want to come back on, we'd be happy to have you because you've been a great guest, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys.
Everything you have to say, we soak up like sponges because we don't have that experience, and we like to live vicariously through our podcast guests. So.
With shooting bull elks and catching
bobcats. Right. I've never held an elk in my hands. Shake the hand of a man who has.
You get divorced and have no life, and you can do stuff like that.
Usually divorce comes with being broke, though, so... You're doing good if you got it figured out the other way. We have a lot to learn from you.
On that note, we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye.
Appreciate it.
All right, everybody, that's a wrap. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please make sure you go on iTunes and shoot us a rating. That does us a lot of good when you guys do that. If you guys have questions for Ken Kesson, on the 16th is the deadline for those questions. Ken Kesson is the local deer biologist here out of the Jones office. I know a lot of you locals tuned in to hear David talk today, so if any of you hunters out there in the area have any questions for an actual deer biologist in our area, let us know by the 16th. We're going to be sitting down the 23rd to record that, and it's going to be a lot of fun, so definitely keep your ears to the ground for that one. If you have questions, shoot us an email at raxfurandfeathers@gmail.com. Look us up on Twitter at @RFFpodcast. Look us up on Facebook at Rax Fur and Feathers. There's a group and a page. And make sure you guys check us out on Instagram at Rax Fur and Feathers. As always, all music and artwork is done by Shane Yoder from PutThemInASong.com and the Root Note Podcast. And all editing is done by the Kyle Palmotter. As always, you guys have a great time out in the woods, on the ice, whatever you're doing, and we'll talk to you soon.